Live from the NBC News radio broadcasting studios of KCAA, 1050 AM, 102.3 FM, and 106.5 FM, located in beautiful sunny California, and in parallel from the Turfs Up radio studio in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and you can find them at turfsradio.com. Thanks for tuning into the Water Zone this evening. Welcome, everybody. I am Rob Starr. I'm the host tonight, and hopefully Mr. Chris Davies, I don't know if he's calling in. He was supposed to be calling in. He's at home right now.
So, Chris, I'm right here on the line with you, buddy.
Oh, okay, great. So Chris is here. Congratulations, you made it. And we missed you last week, and I'm glad you called in tonight. I know you'll be back next week sitting here right next to me. Again, I got to get a cutout figure of you so I can see you here.
I think that's a great idea, man. We've talked about it before, just getting the budget to get that done, right?
Yep, that's the way to do it.
We'll make that fly for us.
Absolutely. Well, I just want to remind our listeners that we started a contest called, and this was for July Water Month, called Extreme Water Makeover. And we're letting it go a little longer because the water agencies were a little slow in getting out the messages to all their, I guess it's they're talking about almost 500,000 homes. In Orange County. We're starting off in one county at a time, and we'll grow from there. But anyway, what the contest is you send in a photo of your front yard along with a short narrative, 300 words or less, and tell us why you need a extreme water makeover. And the goal is to use water more efficiently and to reduce your monthly water bill. And there's great prizes for the winner. You get a complete front yard irrigation system update, get EPA WaterSense and EPA Energy Star in-home appliances, and you get a certified low flow shower heads and toilets provided. We have great sponsors who's partnered up with us to do this. One is the Municipal Water District of Orange County in California, the Home Depot, Howard's Appliances, Kellogg's Garden Products, NBC News Radio, of course, and Pearl's Premium Sod and Grass, and also, obviously, because they sponsor us and we work for them, the Toro Company. So it's pretty exciting, Chris. We got a lot of entries so far. I looked today.
I think there's pretty much approaching what several dozen that have qualified and got through the screening. So it's exciting to see that. It just illustrates one thing, Rob. There's a lot of need out there, and people understand. They're cognizant of the fact that they may be wasting water and a big water user. And so it's great to see people's consciousness come forward and them take action to try and win the contest.
Yep. And I didn't see your submission, but one, you're not allowed, and two, your yard is beautiful and you don't have to worry about it, and three, you understand irrigation because you work for Toro. So if you didn't, we wouldn't do it. Anyway, we're very happy about that. Anyway, today is a training show, and it's a training show to talk about basic irrigation products. We have a gentleman who we're bringing in. His name is Mr. Brent Meekum. He's the Industry Development Director for the Irrigation Association. If anybody's ever seen his business card, this guy's got more credentials than anybody I know, more acronyms on the card. In fact, it's a fold-out card. You open it up, it's like about 36 inches long, everything this guy does. He's really good. I'm very proud that I know this gentleman. He's really a nice guy and smart guy in the business, Mr. Brent Meekum. Brent, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Rob. And no, my business card is not 36 inches long. It does fit my pocket.
Yeah, but it's a fold-out. It's a fold-out one. It stretches with all your credentials on the back of it.
If this was the Roman times, guys, they'd open up the scroll for Brent Meekum. It would roll down to the floor and down the steps all the way to the gallery.
Yeah. I doubt that very much. Anyway, you guys are too kind.
Yes. Just so people know, he's a certified irrigation designer, a certified landscape water management, a certified landscape irrigation auditor, and on and on and on and on. And I won't embarrass him anymore. He's really a good friend in the industry, but he's also a good personal friend, so we appreciate that. So we're going to start with him. For those of you who are listening in, and if you want to watch this because you can see the screenshots, we do it on video, you can go to kcaaradio.com, you can go to ustream.com, and you can go to Tiki Live. Those are the three main ones that will be broadcasting this show tonight on video. And you do get credit for those listening who are in the industry. You do get a credit, a continuing education unit. For those homeowners, this is actually really a good thing for anybody, because a lot of people don't know anything about irrigation. And the way I find that out is I go down to the big box store, and I see them going in and asking for parts, and the poor person that's helping them has no clue on giving him what the right thing is and trying to understand what the problem is. So anyway, halfway through the show, we're going to let you know a code. And when we give you that code, it'll be a WZ and dash something, and I'll give you those later. You simply write that an email to the irrigationassociation.com, and you tell them the number that we give you, and that'll prove that you listened to the show or watched it, and you can get your credits that way. Also coming up for the IA, which is really important, a big thing for us, the Toro Company, is the IA Show and Education Conference. That's December 2nd through 6th. Brent, you got any comments about that?
Well, I think it's going to be a very exciting show. It will be in Las Vegas this year, and the last time we were there, we had like a record turnout. And the other part that makes it exciting is it's also in conjunction with the Groundwater Association.
Right.
So it's really two shows kind of combined on the same exhibit hall, so we have like twice the number of vendors. There's a lot of enthusiasm and excitement, and so it kind of covers many aspects of water. So it's the guys who drill the wells and supply the water, and the irrigation industry that's trying to distribute it where it needs to be.
Yep, so, water agencies, everybody, educational people. They just have to go to www.irrigation.org, and they can find out more and register. And so that's something that you can't miss. We'll see you there, and we'll be broadcasting a live show from there as well. So, Brent, the only thing I'm going to tell our audience is, as we show these slides, Brent happens to be almost 1,200 miles away from here, and normally the person's usually sitting next to us, and we control the slide presentation. But so what's going to happen is, as Brent finishes each slide, please go ahead and, Brent, and just say next, and then we go ahead and advance that. For the people that are listening, please feel free to call in and ask any questions you want. You have Brent, who can certainly answer anything. And if you wanted to hear from me or from Chris, he's on, I'm on. We can belly up and say some things. So the call-in lines for anybody who does have questions is 888-909-1050 or 909-792-5222. And again, anybody who needs to see this versus hearing it, you can go to kcaaradio.com, and you'll see us up on the screen, and you'll see the slides. You can go to Ustream, or you can go to Tiki Live. Those are the three things. I think there is a delay, so if you're listening to the radio and you're watching this, I think this is a 3 to 10 second delay. So either do one or the other so you won't get confused. So, Brent, I'll let you start. I'll turn the show over to you, and we'll get your first slide up here, and I'll tell you when we're ready. We are ready, and it starts as pressure regulation.
Okay, so pressure regulation. So really, for the folks that are listening in, my topic tonight is kind of really it's technologies, irrigation technologies that can save water. And everybody's interested in it at this time of year when it's getting hot, and it's very noticeable when you drive around and you look and you see stressed areas in people's yards. You know they're not overwatering. And so this is the time of year when it's maybe the most difficult to keep up with the watering. And yet, a lot of times what happens is people don't adjust the controllers and things like that later on, and so they begin to overwater. And, yeah, their yards will look greater than ever, but they're probably using way more water than they really needed to. So I'm going to start off with pressure regulation. This is, especially in California, a very timely subject because yesterday the California Energy Commission passed a regulation that says all new sprinkler heads starting in 2020, that will be sold in the state, will have to have pressure regulation. And so California and Colorado and Washington State, Hawaii, and I think it's Vermont, are states that are now mandating sprinklers have pressure regulation. So what is pressure regulation? So I have a slide here that looks, you know, like the sprinklers are spraying a lot. And most homeowners, including myself, will think, well, that's really impressive. That looks cool. But it's actually too much pressure, and so we're not getting the performance out of the sprinklers or the nozzles, and we're not getting the water to go where we want it to be. And so that's why this idea of pressure regulation is so powerful. California looked at it and said, you know, in 10 years' time, if we can change out all the sprinklers that are in the state, it would be enough water to supply San Diego for a year. that would be the water savings just on lawn irrigation. And so if you think about that year after year, it's very powerful. And I find it ironic that it was the Energy Commission who was really pushing this. And in California, it's because so much energy is used to move water around the state. And so if they can reduce the water going through the sprinklers, they're saving energy. So it's actually a twofer. We're saving water, saving energy, and so the public wins. So that's really what this little section is going to be. So I'm going to have you go to the next one, Rob. And it's just a quick slide. It's just an example out of some manufacturer's catalog that just shows you that if the operating pressure increases, well, the amount of water coming out of the nozzle also increases. And so it usually runs like if you double the pressure, you're going to increase the flow about 50%, kind of an old rule of thumb. But many people don't realize, and especially a lot of homeowners, that the ideal operating pressure for most spray sprinklers is only about 30 PSI. It's half as much as what you are used to having in your house. So there's a fair amount of water to be saved by getting these sprinklers to operate at the correct pressure. And so it's a pressure-reducing device. It doesn't build pressure. If you need that, you're going to have a pump. But most cities have pretty high pressure, and it's there so that they can have a good pressure throughout their distribution system. But also you have to think about it, that they need to have good pressure in their city main lines for firefighting and protection. So that pressure is there. We just don't need that much in our sprinklers. Next slide.
Oh, Brent, before as you go on, yep. Most people who have homes don't really know if they have high pressure or low pressure. They just think they do. And hopefully you'll cover some of that and how they can find out how to measure that.
That's a great point. And so, in fact, it'd probably be actually a fairly simple thing to do, that if you were to go to a hardware store and look for a simple pressure gauge, and you would need an adapter so it will thread onto your hose bib. That would be the easiest way to check the pressure. And what you want to do is attach that pressure gauge to the hose bib and make sure that you don't have any water running on the inside of the house. And then open up the hose bib, and it should begin to, you'll see the pressure gauge start to increase in pressure. And most of the time, I find that residential properties, it's somewhere between 60 and 80 PSI. And so that tells you, well, you got plenty of pressure for your sprinklers who only need 30 PSI. But if you only had 30, then you would have a real challenge. And I would say it might even be difficult to get any sprinklers to work, excuse me, because there's a little bit of pressure loss in the valves and the backflow device and the piping. So if you have at least 60, I know that you'll benefit from having a pressure-regulating sprinkler for your spray head. So, yeah, so I think you could probably do that for less than $10, probably $6 or $7 to get a simple pressure gauge and adapter for your hose bib, and it'd be a way to check and say, I have adequate pressure.
Great.
Yet a little tip I'll let homeowners know is that a lot of times there's a pressure-regulating device on the water meter, and you may need to get a plumber to make any adjustment like that. But most of the time you don't want to have much more than 60 or 70 PSI inside the house, because you have other devices like your washing machine or your dishwasher that have hoses and solenoids and stuff that activate. And most of the time the manufacturers won't guarantee them over 80 PSI. Go ahead, Rob.
Okay, you're next now on the pressure-regulating sprinkler bodies.
Yes, okay. So, yeah, and all the major manufacturers make the sprinkler bodies, and I think the important thing to know is that all the manufacturers have a unique way of marking the sprinkler bodies so that you can tell when it's in the ground whether you have a pressure-regulating device or not. So they'll have something like PRX, like which would be a pressure-regulating and as an additional feature, or a PRS is another way of saying it. So major manufacturers have that, and people just want to know, by looking at the sprinkler, do they have it? If you don't see any special markings on it, you probably have a sprinkler without any additional features. So next. Oh, so this is a picture. I don't know that I can describe it adequately, but all the major manufacturers essentially use the same technology and principles. They might have small variations in how this is, but I just a clear cutaway of what it looks like on the inside of the sprinkler, because when you take a sprinkler apart, you actually cannot see the device. It's inside the stem, and so it can't be removed or added. It just happens to be there. So let's go on to the next one.
Okay.
So the intent of a pressure-regulating sprinkler is just to get rid of excessive pressure. And this happened to be a little slide that says, you know, that I put it on a sprinkler, and this is a little test stand I was doing, and it was at 70 PSI. And then I put the regulator on there with a nozzle, and it dropped it down to the 30 PSI, which is that preferred operating pressure for spray nozzles. So the devices work. They're fairly inexpensive. And the benefit is huge. I noticed yesterday in an article that I read at the Sacramento Bee, where the regulation was done up in Sacramento, California, and this is the National Resources Defense Council, who was, you know, applauding the fact that this regulation was made because it's such a simple device that gets good results. And it doesn't take it, you know, it's sort of low technology, but a very powerful technology. Let's go on to the next slide.
You know, like on your first slide, when you showed all of that with the misting, people don't understand, most of them, that when you have little tiny water droplets that get to be misting and it's sort of a windy day, all that stuff gets blown away. It's all wasted. You can't use the water after that.
Yes. In fact, there's a lot of physics and science that go behind these nozzles that the manufacturers make, and they really want that droplet to be a certain size so that it has enough mass to sail through the air to get out there the 12 or 15 feet, whatever the design for the nozzle is. And if the droplet gets too small, then it doesn't have enough energy to actually go that distance. So like you said, it missed and gets blown away. And one of the things I do know is that, and this is for homeowners and contractors working with homeowners, is when you go and fix the sprinkling system that's been overpressurized for a long time, and we put the regulators in place, people will think we have broken the sprinkling system because there isn't this big rush of water going out all over the place. But in reality, we are making it better. I just had a couple of slides that just kind of show the impact of the pressure regulator when it's tested at various pressures, how much water is going through there without the regulator. When you have the regulator in place, that it's staying very close to the ideal amount of water. So let's go to the next slide, too, there, Rob.
Okay, we're on rotor performance.
Yes, and so there are a couple of manufacturers who likewise are making these pressure-regulating devices that fit into the rotors for the larger turf areas, not the spray heads, but the ones that are going to be throwing 35 to 50 feet. A couple of manufacturers have started making those. I think we will probably see more in the future. But the rotors need higher pressure to operate anyway, and so I think the Energy Commission and EPA WaterSense and stuff have focused on the spray nozzles because, quite frankly, that's the vast majority of sprinklers in the residential marketplace, and it's millions of these sprinklers all over the country. So we can go on to the next one. So this one is probably one of the more important slides that I wanted to talk about. Is the idea of a pressure-regulating device in the sprinkler is to obviously get rid of the high pressure, and so we have a consistent, more ideal pressure for the nozzle to operate. It actually equalizes the pressure between the sprinklers. And many people don't understand that, but a lot of times the sprinkler that's furthest from the valve may not have as much pressure because so much water has been going out of all the other heads ahead of it that it's not putting out the same amount of water, so you get an unequal amount of water being applied. So with a pressure-regulating device, you suddenly can equalize that amount of water going out. Likewise, if you have some elevation changes on your property and you have some heads that are higher and lower than others, this pressure-regulating device helps equalize the pressure even though you've got some elevation changes going on. And then we obviously have talked about the idea that improved droplet size and performance and rate of flow is what we really achieve. And one of the side benefits that occurs is sometimes the nozzle gets taken or is missing or gets cut off at the mower, that the pressure-regulating device inside the sprinkler stem will reduce how much water can go through that sprinkler. Some of the manufacturers even make it so that it just turns off the water completely. And you may not know that until that area of the lawn is turning brown, and that'll be an indication, well, there's something wrong with the sprinkler. Let's go find it. Oh, look, the nozzle's missing. Let's get a new nozzle and get things working again. So there's a lot of benefit to that. And, you know, one of the ironic things is we tell people frequently to water at night, and they never get to see their sprinklers operating. So it can go many, many times with a missing nozzle, and you could have lawn geysers going off and never realize it. And so with a regulator like that, it would at least either stop it or really minimize how much extra water goes out of the sprinkler.
Brent, should the rule of thumb be, so the first nozzle after the valve, do you take a reading, and then the ones at the end of the line of that should be plus or minus 10%?
Yeah, that's a good rule of thumb, and sometimes that's a little confusing to people, but, you know, if the first head, and then this is a really well-designed irrigation zone, and I'll pick on a rotor. If the first head has 50 PSI, a 10% difference means that the last head ought to have 45. And with good design and hydraulics, you can achieve that. A lot of times in residential properties, a lot of people don't pay a lot of attention to that, and that's another reason for that pressure-regulated device to be in place. Usually you have more pressure than you need, and this way you will get an equal amount of pressure to every nozzle all along the line. So as long as you've got more than what you need, the regulated device really helps. The last little photo I had on this was just from years ago. I did a little experiment when I worked at a water agency of just saying, well, how much difference does, you know, this pressure-regulating device make? And so I had a little zone, and I take these pictures out on the parking lot because it's like an instant picture of where the water's going. And, you know, it turned out that this design, which was an amoeba-shaped piece of grass, which are very common but very difficult to irrigate efficiently, it just showed that as we had 30 PSI, well, we had a precipitation rate of 1.7 inches an hour. But if we went up to 45 PSI, well, we almost were 2 inches per hour. If I went to 60 PSI, I was like 2.25 inches per hour. So I was watering the same area, but the water was going on a lot faster. And if I looked at the catalog and did all my scheduling based upon the ideal pressure, I was actually putting on 25-30% more water than I thought. And so that's one of the real powerful things about the pressure regulating device, is getting the nozzles to work correctly and match what the catalog says. Let's go next. So a couple of things that are important for people to know. Number one, and especially for contractors as you recommend this to customers, you need to have what they call a pressure differential. That's kind of a big term, but it just means that I need like 5 or 7 PSI more than the ideal in order for the regulator to work. So if I only had 33 PSI at my head and I put on my pressure regulating sprinkler for 30 PSI, it probably won't work. But if I had 40 or 50 PSI out there, then the regulator will work. So there needs to be that pressure differential in order for the little device inside to actually take place. So check the pressure before you make the recommendation to change these. But most of the time, I find that people have 45 to 50 PSI in their yard, and so they're really going to benefit from the pressure-regulating sprinklers. The other thing you have to use on the taller sprinklers, like a lot of times we see 6-inch pop-ups for lawns where the grass is growing and being mowed at a really tall height, or even 12-inch models, maybe you have ground cover or something like that. The important thing to remember is to use the bottom inlet. Now, many of the manufacturers, if they're selling the sprinkler with a pressure-regulating device, that's the only kind of inlet there is a bottom inlet. But years ago, there used to be a side inlet to facilitate installation, because some of us just didn't like to dig holes that deep. And you have to use the bottom inlet because that's where the pressure regulating device is located. So one of the other things that I will tell you is that the regulating device, you need to be sure that you're doing a really good job of flushing out your laterals before you install the sprinklers, meaning that this device will actually trap dirt in it, and then it's not going to work correctly. So before you actually install the nozzle, you want to make sure that you pull the stem out of the sprinkler and you flush water through that and get it nice and clean so you get all the dirt out of the piping on a new installation, and that way you're not going to foul up the regulator. There are 10 manufacturers who make these for sprays. There's two manufacturers that do it for the rotors, and many times that you not only get a pressure regulating device, you also get a check valve, which helps with low head drainage and preventing your pipes from draining in between irrigation events. So I think it's a real win for everybody doing that. Next slide just shows a list of all the manufacturers. We can skip on that and go to the next one. So EPA WaterSense program, which has been around now for 11, 12 years, has a testing specification where they certify the performance of these sprinklers. And I checked just before we got on the air that there are six manufacturers that currently are certified and 103 sprinkler models. So the big manufacturers all see the power of this. As regulations and codes go into place, it's going to become mandatory in many areas. And so it's a win to me because it's a water-conserving device. We're saving energy. We're improving performance of the sprinkling systems. You should be able to see that in how good your landscape looks, and especially the lawn, which suffers sometimes from stress areas and things like that. So it's a great positive, and I think in some markets, because it's WaterSense labeled, there are rebate programs going on. In fact, I think Rob Toro Company has some programs like that in California.
Yes, we do.
All right. I think we're going to move on to the next little type of technology that's starting to get, it's been around a long time, but it's really, in the last couple of years, become much more affordable, and that is called flow sensing. And this, so these are devices that actually will know when the irrigation system comes on. And with the advent of smart controllers and the ones especially that you can operate with your cell phone, flow sensing will actually confirm that your sprinklers are running. Or you may get a signal that says you have flow going on, but your sprinklers aren't supposed to be on. And so a flow sensing device fits into the piping close to the point of connection, and the intent there is to let you know when flow is abnormal, meaning it's usually too high, sometimes too low, or it's occurring when it's not supposed to happen. Next slide. So the technology is changing rapidly. It's been around, actually, for a good long time. The ones that I'm showing on the screen, for those that can see it, these are what we call a paddle wheel type impellers, and so those are spinning around in the flow of water. And depending on how fast they're spinning, it sends a signal that translates it into what the flow rate is. So we can go on the next one and kind of shows you where it goes. The real advantage of this technology is that the price point is dropping. The technology seems to be getting even better. And it integrates with controllers. And so it's a real positive feature. And there are many, you know, sometimes you might wonder, well, is it worth putting on a residential property? But the technology is getting so good that it becomes like a leak detector, and it will let you know that you might have water flowing that you had no idea. And so it, you know, is not only water saving, but, you know, prevent damage. The real advantage is that you have a master valve. So this is a valve before all of your zone valves, and it's connected to the controller. And basically, if the sensor says the flow is happening and it's abnormally high or it's not supposed to be flowing, the master valve will turn the system off for you and prevent a lot of potential damage or waste of water. Next slide.
And does as Brent said, there's the typical paddle wheel type. There's an acoustical version. There's also a new technology. It's been around for a couple of years. It's the ultrasonic type.
The ultrasonic and even vortex.
Right.
And I think what's exciting, and I work with all of these manufacturers, they've been very cooperative in testing their products and trying to validate how well they're performing, is that the price point keeps dropping and dropping. And now we have some that are wireless. And that, to me, is the real exciting opportunity for existing systems. That sometimes it's hard to get a wire from where the flow sensor might go in back to the controller. But if I can do it wirelessly, then that installation will be almost nothing to put that in. The other thing that helps is for people to know is that you need a flow sensor that's really sized for the flow that you're expecting, and it's not necessarily the pipe size. And so many times, like if you had a 3-inch main line on a commercial project, you could probably get by with a 2-inch flow sensor because they actually work better when we have the velocity going through the sensor much higher than what we would typically say for the piping. And so that's another way that maybe the cost can come down, is because its accuracy increases when we get a little bit smaller size. So if we go to the next slide, and I don't know where we're at, but I got one that says sizing, and it kind of shows you that a 1-inch flow sensor can read less than a gallon per minute and all the way up to 50 gallons a minute. Well, that's a huge range. And most of your water supplies are only going to be somewhere around 10 to 12 gallons a minute on a residential property. So a 1-inch meter flow sensor would work, but potentially even a 3/4 one would work. Next slide. Now, there's a couple of things about the installation of these flow sensors. Number one is most of the manufacturers are going to recommend that it's going to be in a straight section of pipe. And so if you have a 1-inch flow sensor, they're going to say, well, you have to have at least 10 inches of straight pipe in front of it and at least 5 inches behind it or downstream of it. And that's a pretty good rule of thumb for many meters to have a straight flow so you don't have turbulence and things like that from elbows or tees that would cause the sensor to misread that. And then the manufacturers all have kind of an interesting way of saying they have a preferred way that they want their sensor oriented. Some of them is straight up and down. Some of them it has maybe a 20-degree tilt. You have to know what the manufacturer wants. And they say these things because they know what it takes for their sensor to give the best reading. Next slide is just, we got, again, manufacturers. They're readily available. I think, in my mind, for what they offer as far as management and potential of water savings and preventing damage, they're very affordable. And over the years, they've become even more affordable. And with the wireless technology, this is beginning to say we need to do this. And it's especially easy with the smart controllers that we have, that this gets integrated seamlessly. You just wire it in, and the sensor and the controller will start communicating. Any quick questions on that? Because I'm going to quickly jump over to soil moisture sensing.
Go ahead.
Okay. So soil moisture sensors have been around for a long time, but they've had a bad rap over the years because we didn't fully understand how to make them properly. And I can remember as a contractor years ago just putting them in and hoping for the best, and it was really challenging. But in the last 10 years or so, we have had some amazing new technology come along that's made these much more reliable and a lot easier to use as a management tool. Next slide. So again, the major manufacturers have them. Some of them are wireless, which is really cool. Again, I like the idea that if it's a wireless technology, it's pretty easy to retrofit an existing controller and system with them and save water. Or some of the other ones I'm going to call are nearly wireless, meaning that they can use the existing wires that control the valve to also be the communication path to the sensor out in the field. And so those kind of sensors are fairly easy to install. We still have others that would need brand new wires. And as long as you're putting in a new system and you know that, or you have planned for it, you know, great way to get soil moisture sensors into your system. Next slide. I like this slide just because it tells a great story that different types of soils hold different quantities of water. And I think it's pretty intuitive to most that sandy soil takes the water in really well, but it can't hold on to it very well. And clay soil, it's really difficult to get the water in, and it can hold a tremendous amount of water. And so that's the key part of this particular slide, is to understand that depending on the type of soil you have, you could have anywhere from about 10% moisture up to 40% moisture in the soil, all depending on the type of soil you have. So doing the soil moisture sensing is great, but you need to have a little bit of understanding about the type of soils that you're working with so that you know approximately what settings that you need to be effective. Next slide. Now, what's the advantage of a soil moisture sensor? For me, it's kind of like it's an electronic route. It sends back information to me that lets me know if the ground is already wet enough, I don't need to be irrigating. And so when there's sufficient soil moisture, it will disable the irrigation. I don't even have to do anything. It just automatically does it. Or on the other hand, when the soil has dried out, it will allow irrigation to happen. And that becomes a real powerful management tool that, you know, especially in the spring and the fall of the year, the frequency of irrigation changes quite a bit. And instead of having to water every other day or every third day, it could be every 5 days or 7 days, or maybe in the fall you get into 10 days apart, which is not very intuitive. You think you need to water more than that. But the sensor is really telling you, this is what the plant is seeing. So no need to water if there's plenty of moisture there. And so the challenge, I think, for most people is to say, well, where do I put the sensor? Typically, we're mostly concerned about our lawn watering, so let's put the sensor in the lawn area. And I just say, let's make it a typical spot of the lawn. And that's kind of hard to describe, but I usually say it's fairly flat. You're located halfway between the sprinklers. It's an area that gets full sun all day long, and so theoretically it must be the area that needs the most water, and everything else will need somewhat less than that, which I can kind of take care of with the number of minutes I put on each station of the controller. A couple of things I will tell and share is you have to have very good wire connection. Most of the failures I see, it is that the wire connection is not very good. It's not waterproof. It's not done correctly. So that is a key thing. And then the other thing is a lot of people say, well, I really don't know what kind of soil I have. I don't know how many minutes to set up. And I will just tell you, well, the good news with the soil moisture sensor is this. If you'll just take the number of minutes that you've been running your system already and create 4 start times. So if you've been running for 20 minutes, I'm going to say, we'll have 4 start times of 5 minutes each. And then, you know, the sensor will begin to know that, okay, I irrigated on the first cycle. I'm still thirsty, so we're going to let cycle 2 start. And it goes through, and after the second cycle and it's had time for the water to soak down around the sensor might say, oh, well, I've got enough water. And then it will disable irrigation, and the other two events won't happen. And I saved half the water that night, not even knowing anything about correct scheduling. So that's one of the things I will tell people. If you don't know exactly what the schedule ought to be, then let's take what you've been doing and just give it 4 or 5 start times. So some clocks, maybe it's only 3, then let's do 3. And if you've got 4, let's do 4. Because the sensor will allow the irrigation to continue going until it says, I'm satisfied, and then it'll quit irrigating. So, let's see. There was one other thought I had about the soil moisture sensors. And
I always tell our customers that if they have a smart irrigation controller or weather-based controller, and they happen to use a soil moisture sensor with it, that the ET controller, the weather-based controller, states when it needs to be watered, and using the soil moisture sensor as a feedback loop. It tells you how much water to water.
Yeah, that's a good way. I think the two technologies are very compatible.
Yep.
Very compatible. And so it's just one of those, you know, the technology is so much better than it was. We get great results. And it's like you said, it gives you a feedback of what the, it's like an electronic root. It knows what's in the soil. And especially if you are in an area where you get rainfall, this is one way to really maximize the benefit of rain. Now, if you live in a desert and it's never going to rain, you may not get that benefit. But many parts of the country that have periodic rains during the growing season, this soil moisture sensor really will maximize, and they'll prevent irrigation from happening too soon because it's saying, well, I got plenty in the soil. So let's go on to the next one.
Hey, Brent, before we do that, can I ask you one question? I get several questions from soil customers, of course, on the telephone. One specific to soil sensors is, you know, many manufacturers provide soil sensors and allow you to attach more than one soil sensor to the controller. So maybe you can answer a similar question I get from many people is, well, do I need a soil sensor for every zone, or do I just need one for, you know, one zone and just leave it alone, or should I put multiple sensors on one zone as some manufacturers controllers
so,
are do? So what's your viewpoint on that?
Yeah, so good question, Chris. And this all has to do with, well, how good of a controller do you have? So many of the things I just talked about, the sensors, not only is the sensor out in the field, but it has a little interface device with the controller. So they will retrofit to any product. So I could put a Toro sensor on a Rainbird controller, or I could put a baseline sensor on a Hunter controller. So those kind, it will be one sensor only. And so I typically say, let's look up the lawn and put that in a representative point. We'll say it's our reference point for soil moisture. And then I need to do a little bit of calculating and be a little bit smart and saying, well, now my flower bed, how do they need water compared to the lawn? And I will have to adjust that in the controller. Or some of them allow you to bypass one or two zones so that they don't operate off of the sensor. On the other hand, if you have a more sophisticated controller, now I'll pick on the Toro Evolution, for example, because I'm familiar with that, you can have three sensors on that controller. So suddenly I can say, well, I have a sensor in the lawn, I might have one for my flower bed, and I might have one for my shrubs. And they could all be operated independently, and I just have to now know which zone on my controller goes with what sensor. And so it depends on how sophisticated of a controller you have. So if it's meant to have multiple sensors, you certainly can. Typically, those controllers cost a little bit more money than a basic controller. And I guess that's one of the things I like about the soil moisture sensor is if I have a controller that's not smart, it's just a timer, I can actually add a soil moisture sensor to it and give it some smart. You'll need a little bit of intelligence on the part of the installer, whether it's the homeowner or the contractor, to maybe try and figure out, well, what's the appropriate amount of minutes of runtime every zone should have compared to the reference zone. And that now brings me back to one of the things I remembered I was going to say. A lot of these soil moisture sensors, because they know that we don't know what kind of soils we have, you actually follow their instructions and you install them correctly, it will learn automatically. So this is that artificial intelligence kind of thing that we're starting to hear about. It will learn what the settings for the soil moisture sensor need to be for when it needs to allow irrigation and when it needs to turn it off. And so it's almost like, okay, this is Brent Meekum proof. You know, I don't even have to know very much. If I just go and put it in and follow the manufacturer's instructions, it will learn its own setting. And I think that's really, really pretty cool. I think the biggest challenge we all have is, can I really trust it? But I think what we really need is to have a little bit of confidence saying, if I did it exactly right and follow the instructions, it is going to work. So
I get that same question. A lot of people say, well, how do I know it knows? Right.
Right.
Speaking of the controller.
Yeah, and I guess I could probably say, well, the censor might want to know that the guy installed me, did he know what he's doing?
Well, I think one of the biggest problems that people have, consumers, when they don't know anything about the controllers and don't know anything much about the soil moisture sensors, they say, hey, it's not watering like it used to water. I think I'll go readjust my controller. Or they change things, and that really screws everything all up.
Yeah. In fact, I find it really ironic that years and years ago, we would spend so much time trying to train and teach people how to figure out the run times for their controllers and get them to do it. And all they wanted to do was put some time on there, and they would set it and forget it. And that's where a lot of water was wasted, spring and the fall, because most of the time it was set up for summer watering.
Right.
Now, when we get these smart controllers and we get everything set up and do it properly, we do want you to forget it, but we made it so easy for them to interface with it, they start playing with it. So I find it kind of just ironic how that has happened over the years, that set
right.
and forget it was a problem, but now we want you to set it and forget it.
Yep.
So people, anyway, people, I think people, this people, needs people. To maybe the last technology I want to talk about. It's been around for a good long time. But a lot of advances are happening, and this is what I'm going to call smartphone-friendly controllers. So we've had the term smart controller for a long time, and these were really kind of weather-based controllers, meaning that it was getting information about the local weather that affects growing conditions. As it gets hotter, then the controller would either say, well, let's increase the number of minutes of runtime, or it would increase the number of days that we're going to have for irrigation. And it would make these changes automatically and start adjusting because it's trying to say, well, weather impacts how plants use water. And so we're trying to mimic that with the controller. I think what's been exciting, and I'm probably going to say it's less than 5 years old, is the idea of being able to access your controller with your smartphone. And so no matter where you're located, you can actually decide whether to turn on your irrigation system, or you can check to see if it's irrigated. Anyway, the smartphone-friendly irrigation controllers are becoming more and more predominant in our marketplace. The price point is getting to be like, you know, I see deals every once in a while. I go, seriously? That's half as much as what it costs to make it. But they are becoming very common. And so I think the opportunities are there, and again, it's one of those things that, okay, this is technology that's outside of my comfort zone, because most of these smartphone-friendly controllers somehow are being able to access the Internet and communicate with their controller at home. I have a similar thing for the furnace and air conditioning in my house. I can access it from wherever I'm at as long as I have an Internet connection, and so that same kind of power is in the palm of our hand with doing irrigation watering. Let's go on the next slide.
They even have that for garage door openers. I just bought a new one that you can control it the same way.
It's everywhere. I mean, we are just becoming more connected. It's the Internet of Things. And so I'm not quite sure I'm ready for a refrigerator that will fill out my shopping list for me.
Oh, they have that. Samsung has one.
I know it.
Yeah. You know, the only thing I can't see is if you take your lovely wife on a vacation to a tropical island or wherever, you know, Europe somewhere, Paris, you know, Italy, and it's really romantic, and you whip out your phone. Hey, I'm going to check on my irrigation system. I don't think that's going to go too well.
You know, maybe you should go to some place that doesn't have Internet access.
Yeah.
No, that would be very remote.
Yeah.
Anyway, these I'm on the slide called connected controllers, I think. Anyway, I typically say they're smartphone-friendly, they're cloud-based, and it all depends on the kind of technology the manufacturer wants to use for connecting to the cloud, whether it's with Wi-Fi or 900 megahertz radio, or it could be cellular connection. All of those are very common in the marketplace. They all have their pros and cons, and sometimes you have to kind of look at your situation to decide which of those technologies works best for my circumstance. So they all work. You just have to kind of decide which one is the best one. But what I think the exciting part of these smart controllers is they now have a kind of a predictive irrigation capability, meaning that it not only knows today this is how many minutes I got to run, but it could look and say, but the probability of rain is 90%. Maybe I shouldn't irrigate. Or, you know, the temperatures are going to be dropping, and so things I could reduce. So this predictive irrigation capability is kind of in its infancy, but I think it's getting better and better. Just have to have access to weather data, which is becoming more common around the country, and allows you to do some monitoring and documenting, you know, why you irrigated, when you irrigated. So that's probably some of the power of these connected controllers, or the smartphone-friendly type controllers. Next slide. Just a little graphic kind of shows you all these systems. It's becoming prevalent in so many of the things that we do that I think we're gaining confidence, really, that this works. And it's certainly, as a contractor, should enhance your capability of really interfacing with your customer and offering a service that doesn't necessarily take your time to drive all the way to their home to make a simple adjustment or to check on, you know, are things working correctly or not. So lots of different manufacturers in the marketplace with these. We can just kind of click through them. Again, you pay a little bit more money for some kinds of technology, but then it's free to use afterwards, et cetera. I'm going to talk a little bit about the programming. It's a little bit different than our regular timers that we've used over the years. The timer has always relied on me figuring out, well, how many minutes should it run and how many days a week should it run? And instead, these controllers ask for information like, well, what's your zip code or your address? What's your sprinkler precipitation rate? Well, that's a major unknown by most people, so you got to go out there and get it a little bit wet maybe and figuring out how fast is the water getting applied. What kind of plants am I trying to water in this station? What kind of soils do I have? How deep are the roots? Do I have watering restrictions maybe given to me by the municipality? Anyway, all of those things get taken into account, and you put that into the controller, and then says, oh, well, with all that information, you're going to water this week on Thursday and then the following Monday, and it'll be for 13 and a half minutes. I mean, there are schedules that we would never want to figure out and program ourselves, but the programming can get down to by the second almost. So it just relies on good information. So the old thing, garbage in, garbage out, really applies to these smarter controllers. But good information will get you great results. Next slide. It's for me, is the technology is actually connecting people to their outdoor space. And people are much more willing to do this if they can do it on their smartphone instead of having to go into the garage and move a lot of things out of the way, trying to get to the controller, which they don't really understand how it functions and operates. And you know, there's been a lot of barriers to why we haven't done better water management, that technology is starting to help us improve with that. Again, these controllers are certified by the EPA WaterSense program. At my last count, there was 30 manufacturers and almost 800 products that are certified to comply with, you know, their premise of how well they can manage irrigation. But it's fast changing. There are more and more innovations coming all along. And I think the last thing I'm going to say is, with all of this technology, none of it is better than how good of a system you have. So if you don't have a very good system, the smart technology won't fix it. You have to start with a good irrigation system, and then the technology helps you manage it and become very effective.
Absolutely. Well, let me give the code for everybody who's listening, because we're almost up to the news hour. It's WZ-6, and you send that to the IA, www.irrigationassociation.org. And
no, it's just irrigation.org.
Oh, irrigation.org. Sorry about that.
Yeah.
I have it on my computer, and I just hit it, so I never look at it.
You're right.
All right, thanks a lot.
So what was that code again, Rob?
WZ-6.
6-6. Okay.
And that'll do it. Well, we're up against the hour. We're going soon. Brent, thank you very much. For those of you who listened and contest of the Extreme Water Makeover, send your photos, send your 300 words why you need it, and send it to waterzone@toro.com. Again, thanks, Brent. You did a marvelous job as always. We're very happy to know you, and you're the best man in the business.
Hey, thank you very much, and great job with